Michael Patrick Lynch's book is called The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. And he's on the line with us right now. And hey, Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How are you?
Thanks for having me.
This is all so true, but isn't it sort of like irreversible now? At the point we have all this data, and some of it actually it may be knowledge, but most of it isn't, right? And it's going more so in that direction. We're getting more and more of things input that we don't even know the validity of, and and it's all going in that direction, isn't it? It's a snowball.
Well, yeah, a snowball is it's a giant glacier.
Yeah,
it would be. A better way of thinking about it. I mean, I think we all know that the internet is the greatest fact checker and the greatest bias confirmer.
Uh-oh, you can't say that on the radio.
You know, spewer.
That's two for you, pal.
I don't know if I could say that on NPR.
A little late to think about that, isn't it, Michael?
Yeah, indeed. Well, you were talking about fertilization earlier.
But that's a nice word.
That's right, but here's the thing. You know, the life that we're living now, which is being totally consumed by this, you know, digitalization,
right.
It's something that's more and more just second nature to us.
Right.
That's what this came
home to me. It's first nature, isn't it?
Yeah, really, first nature. Mm. I mean, we don't even really think about the fact that just a few years ago, our ways of accessing and interacting with information and ways of acquiring knowledge were radically different. And this came home to me just a few years ago when I started out on this project. I asked myself four questions that I really wanted to know the answer to. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, fairly trivial, straightforward questions from my ordinary life. And what I told myself was, okay, I'm going to figure out the answers to these questions without accessing the internet at all. And that turned out to be a really interesting experiment. I encourage all your listeners to actually try this. Now, of course, they should wear their safety goggles because, you know, it can get dangerous out there. But the questions that I asked were ranged from, you know, what's the capital of Bulgaria, which I thought I knew the answer to, and it turns out I did, which was Sofia. I figured that out by just looking up on an old map in my house, to a question... just an ordinary question, what's the contact information of my local U.S. representative? And for that one, I thought that would be easy. I went to the local library, and I asked the kid behind the desk, you know, and he looked at me sort of funny. He said, well, the computers are right over there. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't use the internet. And he sort of paused, and then he just said, okay, and I talked to him a little bit more and explained to him I was not, you know, what I was doing, this sort of crazy thing. And so we hunted around and we found some old phone books, you know, with the old blue pages in it that had governmental numbers. And, you know, what really stumped me was I had a question, what is the best reviewed restaurant right now in Austin, Texas?
Austin.
And that I couldn't answer. In fact, that's a question that we wouldn't have even asked, right?
Right.
Just a few years ago.
Right.
Because... Right now, how can you access it right now? But that's what we can't. Yeah. So really what, you know, this experiment brought home to me was how integrated digital ways of forming, of getting information are into our life.
Yeah.
Into our life. You know, doing that experiment, it was sort of like, I've never done this, but it was a little bit like dressing up in, you know, Civil War costumes and going out and reenacting some battle.
Yeah.
I imagine that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
You know, what it feels like.
So we are now digital life forms, basically.
We are, I think, becoming increasingly digital life forms. In many ways, of course, that's fantastic. You know, I own more computers than I care to admit, and I certainly do the tweeting, and I do the Facebooking, and I do all the things that most of your audience also are going to do. And, of course, when I want information, I do go online. But the thing about Google knowing, as I call it, is that it has certain features, certain philosophically interesting features that no other form of a way of getting information really has. And it's because it has a particular combination of features. On the one hand, as I've been saying, it's deeply integrated and quick and sort of so integrated that we access it in a very passive, quick way. And we also treat it as a default go-to source of information. I mean, how many times have you been in, you know, in a dispute over some fact,
right.
maybe some sort of trivial fact, sports trivia, and everybody whips out their smartphones and tries to verify it right,
right
away.
Hate
it's
that.
It's our go-to.
I hate
thing.
That.
Right.
Used to be guys would argue about something, and then no one won or lost because he right. didn't know the answer.
Exactly.
That was fine.
But now we can access it, or so we think. So, I mean, in a way of thinking about that, you know, we used to say that seeing is believing. Now Googling is believing. Mm. Right. On the other hand, it's integrated, but it's also radically dependent on other people. When we're accessing information on the Internet, we're essentially trusting other people's testimony on various points of information. Now, of course, we've always trusted other people's testimony on things like when we ask directions on the street. And, of course, we've also always looked up things in books and so forth. But the weird thing is this speed and integration and the combination of that with this dependence on other people and, of course, mathematical techniques, that's what's distinctive about Google knowing. And I think we as human beings need to sort of focus on the fact that how we're acquiring knowledge is radically changing even as we speak.
Yeah. And, you know, just in general, I feel like I'm analog. I was raised analog. I'm still analog. I write all this stuff on your book covers here that I wanted to talk about because that's an analog thing to do. When I use
right.
Google Pay. But my kids are digital.
That's right.
And so they're the first, like, all digital generation.
Yeah,
these kids now probably are the first ones that are just not
right.
even an alternative to that. And to me, and just my thing about it is that digital is never analog because it's a sampling of analog things.
Right.
If it's digital, it means they've sampled an analog wave in some way, and it's never going to be the same thing as the actual wave because the wave is where it's at. Everything's wave. Lights in wave, sounds in wave, you know. How about that? I worked on this for some time, and I came to this all on my own, this conclusion. I did not Google it. But, I mean, it's sort of a real departure, I think, just for people in general, don't you think?
I think it is a real departure, and I think the you know, when we talk about digital natives, like I have a 10-year-old daughter, and she's a true digital native in the sense that even my college, you know, the students in my college courses aren't. She has never lived in a time in which there weren't smartphones.
Yeah.
And that does mean that her relationship to the analog is very, very different than mine. Now, I want to emphasize that, again, that that's not, you know, it's not the technology itself that I think is of concerning. It's how we use technology. I mean, if you think about the analogy with the automobile, when it came into our lives and we fell in love with it, we did so because it did things for us. It was convenient. It allowed us to be more independent from each other. And that was good in some ways, but our love affair with it, our valuing it so much, really led to some problems, as we all know.
Yeah, continuing problems.
What we need to remember is that there are other ways to get where we want to go in both transportation, in a sense of transportation, yeah. and also in terms of acquiring knowledge and
yeah.
deep knowledge.
And also in terms of isolation of the individual. We don't really have group. We have affinity groups. You can have groups, whatever, on your Google Plus or whatever. But we don't. We're isolated while we're doing it. Like, so all social networking is really isolationist.
It is. Social networking is, in some ways, it does allow us to communicate with, you know, Facebook friends that maybe old friends that we haven't seen for a long time. We can keep up with them and keep up with their kids, and that's great. But it is funny. It's funny you mentioned the isolationist bit because one of the things that I talk about in the book is Karl Popper, the philosopher from the 20th century, famous philosopher of science. He wrote in the 1940s. He wrote this really interesting thing. He said, "I can imagine that in the future," he said, "men and women will live in cubicles, isolated from each other, talking to each other only through machines, only through machines."
Right.
And I thought, and he also said, you know, and go around in cars that drive themselves, and things like that. Right.
Yeah. So that was a great quote. I saw that pop up.
Right. I mean, one of the things that he was worried about was this thing that you're worried about, is this alienation. But the thing that worries me is not so much individualized alienation from each other, although that is worrying. I think it's this. I think the bigger worry is the isolation that we're in terms of groups. One of the things that the internet, clearly, we all know this, is doing is allowing us to, it gives us all this information. But the funny thing about humans is we have all this information in front of us, but and partly because it's so much, we tend to only access parts of it. Liberals, we read certain blogs, consult certain sorts of news sources, right?
Right.
And conservatives consult other blogs and other news sources. And we construct our own bubbles of reality increasingly. And that, as we're seeing in the present presidential election, can be a very dangerous thing.
Yeah. And I, like on Google News, which I, you know, I definitely, there are sources on there I don't want to hear from. And so they're blocked.
Right.
On my Google. So I get a very jaundiced view. And it's still not very good, frankly. I like to block them all at a certain point. But, you know, I know this other thing, though, this Internet of Things to me is also very disturbing because isn't it somewhat demeaning to be a co-equal with your refrigerator?
Right. I mean, that's, yes, indeed. I mean, one of the things that I think is disturbing and we're not thinking, I think, clearly enough about is that when we digitize everything, which is what we're already doing, as you say, our refrigerator, I mean, there's right now you can go out, and if you don't believe this, Google it right now. you can find smart socks, smart underwear, smart hats, smart dressing rooms, and, of course, as you said, smart refrigerators.
Yeah.
All these things have chips in them that communicate with the Internet, and that in many ways, it can lead to greater convenience.
Yeah.
But
I don't want my refrigerator talking to my stove.
Right, indeed.
Because they'll be saying things behind my back.
God knows the things they'll say to each other, right?
Yeah.
But also, as you said, I mean, one of the things as these chips move farther and farther into our lives, they also, as you said, we start treating ourselves and our technology, in a sense, alike. We treat ourselves as objects to be manipulated in the environment. I mean, one way, dramatic way of putting that is to think about the quote from Larry Page that I cite in the book, which is Larry Page is a Google CEO, and he says, you know, someday we're going to just have implants that we can have in our brains that will allow us to just look up or think about a question and find the answer. Now, that's obviously a long way off, although, of course, as we all know, Google has been working on Google Glass, and they're presently deep into a project on Google Contact, believe it or not, so that you can wear contacts that allow you to access the Internet visually. This sort of drifting inwards of our technology is part of what I'm talking about this radical integration.
Right.
And the thing is that the problem with that is that the cyborging of the human really starts making us seem, well, less human. And we need to think about the consequences of this technology before it gets out of our hands.
Plus, if we have this, if we can Google in our brains and stuff, it means that that's in lieu of actually thinking about something.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? We wouldn't have to think about it.
We wouldn't, because we would consult as some source, reliable or not, and that the thinking would have been done already on whatever the subject was.
Indeed. I mean, which raises, of course, an interesting question as a college professor about, and this is a question that's very much real right now, which is, what are we doing when we're educating? What are we trying to educate people for? I mean, after all, my students right now can access a world of information. Mm-hmm. Much of it, of course, is not very good information, but they can access a world of information, including some very, very good information. On any topic they want, including, let's say, fungus counseling. Cite an example from earlier in your show.
Yeah.
I think that sort of challenges us to think about the different types of knowledge we really are interested in.
And
I think that we want more than just being able to access lists of facts. We need to be able to, cultivate in our students and ourselves skills that allow us to connect the dots, allow us to see how lists of facts are connected to each other, to see what depends on what and why something happens, not just that it happens.
Yeah.
And I call that sort of knowledge understanding. And I think it's the sort of knowledge that if we're not careful, we're going to value less, because the other sort of knowledge, easy knowledge, is, well, easy.
Another thing you mentioned are these information cascades, and of course, I immediately think of Donald Trump,
right,
as a living epitome of an information cascade. There's nothing he can say or do that does not get reported or tweeted or immediately. You know, it's rather alarming,
right,
to say the least. Is that what you mean by an information cascade? That just so much information that actually forms a cascade of too much information.
Well, an information cascade is. That example is an example of information cascade, but let me just add one more remark. When we talk about the cascade of information, what we're talking about is when people start to form beliefs and find a belief more warranted or seem that they'll find it more plausible just because lots of other people have also found it plausible. The more, and we see this, of course, online all the time in various trivial and perfectly innocent ways in terms of internet rankings, right, where people start to think that a particular item is good just because other people thought that it's good. There's this sort of thought that, well, you know, all these people couldn't have been wrong. And in the same way, it works with interest, too, as you said. The more people hear about what Donald Trump said, the more they think, well, there's something to be said for that. And that, of course, is that often is not the case. It's often the case that, in fact, just because a lot of people, you know, the lemmings, right, that run over the cliff, well, just because the other lemmings ahead have run over the cliff doesn't mean it's a good thing for you to do if you're the lemming in the back.
Yeah, so, and that used to be the job of talk radio. So I think
it used to be the job of talk radio and media in general.
Yeah,
now it's. Nowadays, right, of course, when we talk about the media, we're really talking about, in a sense, all of us. All of us are participating in the media because all of us, through our Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts and so forth, are busily manufacturing consent, as Chomsky would have said.
So have you been teaching for many years now, Michael?
I imagine
you have.
I have.
How many years?
20 years. 20 years.
20 years. Have you had to readjust to your students in terms of all these topics? I mean, this is a whole different... I mean, their reaction to all things you're saying would not necessarily be as horrific as some of us older.
Well, people. You know, the funny thing is that I think that might have been true 4 or 5 years ago. But one of the things I've really noticed is that just in the last few years, when I talk about this around the country or I talk about it to my students, obviously I have some very big classes that I talk about this with, mm-hmm. I found that students who are about 18, 19 right now are actually themselves asking some pretty hard questions about digital life. And I think that's in part because, I mean, this is something, I'll give you an example. A student recently said to me, you know, what you're saying really makes sense to me because I've been really worried about my little brother. this kid who's talking to me is 18 years old, right?
Yeah.
Or around there.
Yeah.
And he's watching his younger brother, you know, I don't know how old he was, but and he's worried about the fact that his younger brother is not reading books, he's accessing everything through the internet and is too trusting with it. So one of the things that I think is really interesting about some of the, is that there are people out there, young and old, like myself, who while using digital technology all the time, mm-hmm. and that's certainly me, are also trying to pay attention to how we're using it. So I actually have some, things, of course, have changed with how students look at digital technology. I have some hope that people are paying attention nowadays.
Yeah, and this book should help. It's called The Internet of Us. Thank you so much, Michael. Very interesting talking to you. There's a lot to think about here, and that can only be good.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. The Internet of Us, Michael Patrick Lynch.